This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
An Erio's original.
Each week, we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week, you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado-Smith, and this is The Aftermath. The Aftermath. Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Aftermath. Today, we will be speaking with guest expert Dr. John Kirk. He's a history professor at University of Arkansas at Little Rock and author of Beyond Little Rock, The Origins and Legacies of the Central High Crisis. Let's hear what he has to say about the Little Rock Nine. Hi, Dr. Kirk. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So can we start off by having you tell us a little bit about your background and how it has led you to all of your research for the Little Rock Nine?
Yeah, well, as listeners might be able to tell, I grew up in the United Kingdom. I'm from England, and got interested in race relations in the United States while doing my undergraduate degree at the University of Nottingham. I took American Studies there, and in my senior year, I did a thesis on William Faulkner and race, and that kind of got me interested in race relations in the South. And then I went to the University of Newcastle upon Tyne to do my PhD on the civil rights movement in Arkansas. At the time, you know, there were a lot of books that had written the national story of the civil rights movement, but a number of books were starting to come out that looked at local and state level politics and the long history of the civil rights movement stretching back into the 1940s and up to the present day. And Little Rock was one of the places that obviously was a hotspot in the civil rights movement with the school crisis in 1957. So I wrote a long history of the civil rights movement for my first book that kind of contextualized the Little Rock school crisis within decades of African-American activism within Little Rock and within the state.
Why don't you, if you could, help set the stage for us. What was 1950s Arkansas like?
It was still pretty impoverished and pretty rural. The state was experiencing a kind of decline in its cotton economy and was about to tip the balance in the 1960s from a rural agricultural to a manufacturing economy. And lots of people were leaving because of this decline in rural cotton economy. Arkansas was experiencing massive depopulation. So the population was going down. The state was in kind of economic crisis. But Little Rock is kind of different from the rest of the state. You know, Little Rock is one of the few urban centers at that time, probably the only real urban center right at the heart of the state, so right in the middle of the state, which is important, I think, because, you know, Arkansas is something of an odd state. It straddles both the South and the Southwest and the West and the Midwest on each of its sides. So in the kind of southeastern part of the state, Arkansas shares much in common with the Mississippi Delta. The Arkansas Delta is the kind of flip side of that, the other side of the Mississippi. And that's where the massive amount of the African-American population has always been concentrated with its legacy of cotton and slavery. But the northwest part of the state is quite different. It's a place of rolling hills and going up into mountains. And it has traditionally had a very small black population. Many of those counties had no black population at all. And Little Rock is kind of wedged right between those two very different sorts of parts of the state. So it's a kind of interesting crucible where the sort of southern delta starts to meet the west and Midwest. So it's a fascinating sort of place location geographically.
Yeah, I had never thought of that. So after the Supreme Court rules that segregation is unconstitutional, nothing happens for a few years. What's the holdup?
Well, there are a number of reasons. Firstly, when the Supreme Court hands down its ruling in Brown versus Board of Education, it delays the implementation order for a year. So it says schools have to desegregate, but it doesn't really give any guide to how they have to desegregate or when, or put anything in writing in terms of what has to happen. All they do is say this has to happen. And in the meantime, they hope they can get feedback, they can get the soundings of southern states and others in government to try and help them show a way in which they can achieve this. But the support is not very forthcoming at all levels. You know, Eisenhower is the president at the time, demurs, and in private, he says he doesn't think it's a good idea. In public, he's fairly lukewarm in support. Congress is pretty hostile, 101 Southern senators and congressmen write a Southern manifesto that says the ruling is unconstitutional. So the Supreme Court is in a tight place. And in 1955, a year after, in May 1955, a year after the Brown v. Board of Education decision, it announces its Brown implementation order. And this implementation order is quite ambiguous. It doesn't really give much of a timetable. Famously, it says schools should proceed with all deliberate speed in desegregation. So the timetable is really slow. There's no real indication about what should happen in terms of how schools should desegregate, at what grades, and all those kinds of things. So it's quite a difficult setup to operate within. And in Little Rock, Virgil Blossom, who's the superintendent of schools, delays doing anything on school desegregation until that implementation order comes down. But then, perhaps surprisingly, in lieu of what light of what things happened afterwards, Blossom is one of the first, Little Rock is one of the first school districts to announce compliance with Brown v. Board of Education after the implementation decision comes down. And Blossom sort of takes a lot of responsibility for drawing up what becomes named after him, the Blossom Plan for School Desegregation. But it's a curious plan that he puts together, because in planning for desegregation, he builds more segregated schools in the city. At the time, the two main schools, a Central High School, which as the name suggests, is pretty centrally located near downtown Little Rock, and which is the white high school. And there's Dunbar High School, which is in the African-American neighborhoods, which are not that far away from Central. They're closely located to one another. But one is the school that black students go to, one is the school that white students go to. And in order to desegregate schools, Blossom builds two new schools. One is Horace Mann High School, which is clearly located in the black neighborhoods of Little Rock, out towards the east. And the other is Hall High School, which is built in the white neighborhoods to the extreme west of the city. So it's clear that new schools are being built in racially designated areas, presumably in the hopes that the catchment area will keep them, in practical terms, still segregated, even though they're supposed to desegregate. So you have this new school building project, and Blossom assures the local members of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People that they had no color designation and that, you know, they're just new schools to expand for capacity. But then in February 1956, as Horace Mann is about to open, they assign an all-black teaching staff there, which clearly designates it as a black school. And it's at that point that the NAACP launches its lawsuit.
Wow. I hadn't understood the complexity of how these zoning of the schools played into it. So how were these students chosen? And how was Daisy Bates involved in the process?
I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about how the students were chosen. And, you know, a lot of that is filtered through segregationist propaganda at the time that said, you know, a lot of the sort of segregationist groups in Arkansas said these were students who were chosen by the NAACP and shipped in from the north. And, you know, they were stooges and all that kind of stuff. But the fact is, you know, the Little Rock Nine self-selected. Blossom opened applications to apply for schools. And around 200 African-American students applied to go to the formerly all-white Central High School. But then Blossom, you know, put a series of tests in place and to sort of weed out students and deter them from going. For example, he'd tell them when they turn up for interview that, you know, you're not going to be able to go in school band or participate in any sports activities because they're not going to be desegregated, so you're going to lose all those opportunities. He insisted that any applicants had to have a certain IQ. So all of these things that white students didn't have to face were put up as barriers for black students. So in doing so, he kind of whittled down and wore down the kind of resolve of black students to apply until it came down in the end to a final 10. There were 10 at the end, and then 9 eventually ended up going into Central High. But it was only really then, once the students had self-selected, that the NAACP became involved. And Daisy Bates, who was head of the state, a conference of branches for the NAACP in Arkansas, sort of helped to mentor them and, you know, gave them guidance about what they should do and, you know, how to go about the process and all those kinds of things. So the students were really, you know, determined and took their own choices, and their families took the choices to be in the firing line and kind of take this step towards school desegregation. It was only after that that the NAACP, through Daisy Bates, became involved.
Interesting. So what now that we've kind of set the scene, can you walk us through how it played out for the Nine?
The Nine survived all of these rigorous tests that Blossom put in their way. And they were, you know, students who were clearly intelligent and willing and determined enough to go through with this process. And many of them, you know, had very legitimate reasons for wanting to go to Central High School. That is, they lived closer to it. Central High School at the time was in a fairly mixed area of residence. You know, it was what they call in the South salt and pepper neighborhoods, that is, black and white areas of residence mixed together. And many of them lived a lot closer to Central High School than they did to Horace Mann. So it was easier to walk or, you know, catch a bus closer to school at Central than it was to go to Horace Mann. Others wanted to take classes for their careers that were at Central High School that weren't available at black schools. So, you know, there were very practical reasons. I don't think many of the Little Rock Nine sort of thought themselves as breaking the color line, you know, as civil rights pioneers. I think, you know, they had this idea that they could get a better education there, and that's what they wanted for themselves. And they became sort of civil rights pioneers in the process. Maybe if they fully understood and known everything they were going to go through, they might have thought twice about it. But, you know, they wanted a better education, so they decided to go through that. So the plan really starts to unravel, the Blossom plan, during the final days leading up to school desegregation. Blossom has delayed it to build these new schools and all that kind of thing, but he set September 1957 as the date in which schools are going to desegregate. And just before, the day before they're due to desegregate, Orville Forbus, who's the governor of Arkansas at the time, calls out the National Guard to surround Central High School. And nobody really knows what's going to happen. He releases a very ambiguous statement that says the soldiers are not there to be integrationists or segregationists, but just to uphold law and order and all those kinds of things. So it's very ambiguous as to what's going to happen. And so the Little Rock Nine prepared to go to school the next day. Daisy Bates kind of rallies them. And a lot of the times they gather at her home and all travel together. But on that particular morning, Elizabeth Eckford, one of the Little Rock Nine, didn't have a telephone. Her family didn't have a telephone. And Daisy Bates was kind of, you know, trying to organize everything and phone around and get everybody in line. And she couldn't get to Elizabeth Eckford. So Elizabeth Eckford turned up that morning all alone at the school to face a large white mob that had gathered outside of the school, as well as the National Guard. And when she tried to enter the school, the National Guardsmen stood there and blocked her way and refused to let her enter. And at that point, it became apparent that the National Guard were in fact there to stop the black students going into the school. So Elizabeth Eckford was turned away and she walked towards the bus stop, clear that it wasn't going to get in. And, you know, it's quite a hairy set of circumstances. You know, the white mob followed her, screaming and yelling at her. And she sat at the bus station and one white woman, Grace Lorch, was there to kind of look after her, I suppose, and, you know, kind of guided her from the mob and got on the bus with her. And, you know, then she got away from the scene, thankfully, unharmed. But it was quite a precarious situation that she was placed in.
So after they are able to return and they're being escorted by the troops, there were still they still endured incredible amounts of hatred and harassment. I believe that you've had firsthand accounts. You've heard firsthand accounts from the Nine. What was it like for them?
Pretty traumatic, of course. You know, they were suddenly thrust into this national spotlight and this wholly tempestuous situation. You know, with the mobs and national headlines and international school international newspaper headlines around the world. So they were, you know, found themselves really at the center of the hurricane, the center of the storm. And, you know, a lot of the forward momentum for desegregation then lay upon their shoulders. You know, the fact was that if the segregationists could stop the Little Rock Nine from attending Central High, then it would remain segregated. They were the only students, the only people separating desegregation from maintaining segregation at Central High. So effectively, you know, the whole pressure fell on their shoulders then to go into the school and to stay into the school. So there's a huge amount of pressure on them. And, you know, right, that continued throughout the school year. Yeah. You know, we usually think of the Little Rock school crisis as, you know, the events of September 1957 and the calling out the National Guard and then Eisenhower calling out the federal troops and all those kinds of things. But, you know, that was on the shoulders of Little Rock Nine throughout the school year. And once the school desegregated and once, you know, it was under federal occupation and they had federal escorts, they still faced a whole barrage of assaults and intimidation in the school because then the attention switched to getting them out of the school. Once they got in, you know, white students there, many of them who were the sons and daughters of the leading segregationists in the city, knew that if they could get them to leave voluntarily, then the school would remain segregated. So they physically intimidated black students throughout the year in order to try and get them to leave on their own will and keep the school segregated that way.
Well, you know, we read a lot about the students and the Nine, but I'm curious about the adults who were directly involved. What was the reaction of the teachers and the faculty?
Yeah, I mean, all the reports suggest that it was pretty mixed. There were some who were actively hostile to Little Rock Nine being there. There were some who, you know, reached out in support, and most were fairly ambivalent. You know, we got to remember that Central High School is a school of around 2,000, maybe about 1,600 just that year attended because the numbers fell off and people went elsewhere because of all the trouble that had occurred at the beginning of the year. But still, the Little Rock Nine students were massively outnumbered. So it's easy enough to be a student in the schools, particularly if you're not in the, you know, in the same year, to just be unaware of what's going on because the federal troops leave fairly soon afterwards. And the National Guard, a very limited number of National Guardsmen are there to protect the students in the school. So, you know, it's easy enough to just ignore the fact that those students are there unless they're in one of your classes. So, and unless, of course, as a teacher, if you're teaching them. So, you know, life went on much as normal in the rest of the school. It was just, you know, the Little Rock Nine who experienced a very different sort of school year to the rest of the school body.
What were some of the reactionary groups that formed in Arkansas as a resistance to desegregation? And what part did they play in all of this?
Right. At the very forefront was the White Citizens Councils, which formed across the South after Brown versus Board of Education. They formed with the explicit program of preventing school desegregation from occurring. And the head of the White Citizens Councils in Arkansas was a man called James D. Johnson, or as they called him, Justice Jim Johnson. He was later sat on the Arkansas Supreme Court. And he built his political career as a fairly young man on the basis of opposing Brown v. Board of Education, which many politicians did in the South. And he proved important because he was kind of a political opponent of Orville Forbes. And he was a Democrat too. Of course, Arkansas was solidly Democratic at the time. You know, the state was, you know, part of the solid Democratic South, one of the most solid Democratic states in the South. So Republicans didn't really feature at all. And the vying for Democratic power was the most important thing. So Forbes was elected in 1954, just after Brown v. Board of Education. And throughout the campaigns, he remained fairly ambivalent. He said it should be handled at a local level. And, you know, he kind of trod a line between moderation and, you know, support for segregation, but not a kind of militant opposition to it. But in 1956, when he ran again, there were just two-year terms for governor then. Jim Johnson entered the race. Yeah. So Jim Johnson entered the race in 1956, and he took on Forbes for the right to be governor. And, of course, Jim Johnson was a firebrand pro-segregationist and had pretty extreme militant, you know, segregationist rhetoric. And many observers would say that pushed Forbes into taking a stronger anti-desegregation stand himself. So in fighting these primaries, Johnson kind of helped to stiffen Forbes' stand against segregation, and therefore he started to make much more pro-segregation noises. But interestingly, after the election, when Forbes had won, he started to back away from that again and started to go back to his more moderate stance and, you know, some of the things that he got through the Arkansas General Assembly to prevent school desegregation, he didn't really fully implement. So Forbes sort of backed off again. So the resistance is really important in terms of changing the political atmosphere in Arkansas at the time and making the state, forcing the state to take a much more pro-segregation stance.
So are there other factors at play here that we haven't discussed?
I think there's a whole, you know, if you're looking for the, you know, to assign blame on who was responsible for the Rot School crisis, there's a whole series of candidates. You know, Forbes is the obvious one
Well, yeah, let's go there. You know, if you had to pick, you know, one person or thing, it can also be a concept or an idea that you think is to blame for the Little Rock Nine. Who or what would that be?
Well, of course, segregation is to blame at the roots of it all. If there weren't segregated schools in the first place, they wouldn't have to desegregate. And what you're kind of trying to untangle is something that you've already instituted over many decades. So, I mean, that's the key thing. I mean, that's to blame. But, you know, if you're looking at individuals, Orville Forbes is probably the key character who you would blame because he was there, you know, right at the heart of this and making the key decisions at the time of the school crisis. But Forbes would look to Virgil Blossom and leaders in the community in Little Rock and say, you know, he just was cleaning up their mess and that the school desegregation plan they could come up with was inadequate. And that was to blame. You know, it hadn't done its job. And, you know, at the last minute, as things unraveled, they hadn't done the preparations and he had to pick up the slack for their mistakes. I think Blossom and the people in Little Rock would say, you know, it's the Supreme Court's fault that they shouldn't have made this ruling in the first place. And they transferred all the blame down to us. And we had to, you know, deal with all this and we weren't equipped to deal with it. And we have people here in the state who didn't want desegregation, so the Supreme Court shouldn't have forced us to do that in the first place. Supreme Court would probably point to Eisenhower and the politicians in Congress and say, you know, we said schools should desegregate and we gave everybody a year to figure out how to best do that, but all we got was opposition and the president refused to back us strongly and Congress refused to back us strongly. So we had to hand down this watered down decision in order to remain unanimous and to be able to move school desegregation forward at all. So there is this kind of blame game where people would point to one another and say, you know, you're the problem, that's the reason. Because, you know, segregation underlines all this. That's what sets the chain of events in motion. If segregation hadn't been established in the first place, the United States wouldn't have had to undo it, and the Supreme Court wouldn't have had to make the ruling that it made. But that sort of sets off the chain reaction. And then it's a question, really, of, you know, who wants to accept responsibility? Everybody's trying to avoid responsibility because desegregation, particularly in the South, is politically unpopular. And nobody wants to take responsibility and step into the role of being politically unpopular. So they all try and sort of evade the issue as far as they can. And that's why you kind of get this 11th hour crisis, because at some point something happens that, you know, at the point that black students tried to get into the school, then something has to happen. Then you're at a point of decision. And up to that point, it's been more indecision than decision.
So sounds like John Kirk is pointing the finger at evading responsibility.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a good way to put it. There's a quote that says, you know, all that has to happen for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. And I think that's, you know, what you see at Central High School. People who, you know, refuse to take leadership responsibility, leave everything to everybody else. And then, you know, that's how crises happen. Vacuums of leadership, lack of responsibility. And then people like Forbes, you know, can step into those vacuums of responsibility and take charge at quite short notice and play very sort of fundamental roles in the way that things unfold. So if you don't have the structures in place initially, then, you know, you hold hostages to fortune. And that's what happened at Central High.
Well, Dr. Kirk, thank you so much for joining us today and helping us understand, you know, one of these big, you know, civil rights moments in our country.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With us today, we have producer Amanda Lund.
Hi, Rebecca. Hi, Alarmy.
So I'm so happy we had John on the show.
Me too. He brought up, you know, of course, I'm taking copious notes, as always, when we have the experts. He brought up some really interesting points. But overall, I feel like we were in the same area. So that felt good.
That felt good. Yeah. He did say the most obvious one was the governor, and that is who we ended up sending to jail. But I loved his blame game. And I do think that this is a something we might incorporate in the future when there are so many players involved.
I liked it, too, because he had the perspective of who would the people involved blame.
Yeah.
So this is what he said. Uh-huh. I wrote it down. He said, okay, well, first, glaring error, we didn't put segregation up on the board.
Whoa. That's like our Manson episode when we didn't put the killers. We apologize for that.
And in defense of us, we were just, I think we assumed that's a given. So,
right.
Yes. Okay. And we did acknowledge that segregation was involved.
We definitely talked about segregation.
Okay. So he said that, let's see, that Faubus would maybe have blamed the Supreme Court because they shouldn't have made the ruling in the first place before the state was ready. The Supreme Court would have blamed Eisenhower and Congress for not coming up with systems to make desegregation happen, which I thought was mm-hmm. really interesting. And then at the end of the day, he said that people were evading the issue because they didn't want to become politically unpopular, which goes into evil politics.
That's right. It really is it's full circle. It's a vicious, ugly cycle that causes, you know, like he said, 11th hour decisions to be made. And perhaps, you know, clearly in this case, it was not the right call, I think, for Faubus to, you know, send the National Guard and to do it in the way that he did. Obviously, it created a national, you know, media frenzy and bad media that then, you know, it just got so big. I don't think that was his intention.
Yeah, because you're like, if Eisenhower or someone had been like, segregation is happening, whether you like it or not, like it's coming from the top, this is how you're going to do it, then Faubus could have at least had an out with his constituents and been like, daddy's making me do it, you know, but instead it gave him the opportunity. And this is what Dr. Kirk said too, that because there was a vacuum of leadership, Faubus stepped mm-hmm. into that position.
Right.
And that's when everything just totally went to shit. Not like it would ever have been easy, but it could have been a lot better.
Smoother, definitely.
Yeah.
Now, but dare I say this, that in a way it is good that it happened because it did put the national spotlight on the issue of segregation. So it's a double-edged sword in that sense where, you know, obviously traumatic, and the fact that they had to go through that, like no child should have to go through what the Little Rock Nine went through. And it really forced people to, you know, start having these conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's interesting.
I mean, it should never have happened.
But what would a place like Arkansas, like what would, even if there had been a federal plan, do you like maybe it would have still just ended up the same anyway, because the people,
right.
They didn't want desegregation. They just didn't. They straight out didn't want it.
Like what? I just can't imagine what it would be like to be a black resident of that state.
God.
Just to live with that, you know, day in and day out. It must have been incredibly traumatic. How do you live like that?
I mean, and we see it in the South, like it's not like those scars are fully healed. There's still a lot of tension.
With good reason.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense. So, yeah, it's just really important that we keep learning. I personally hadn't really known much about the Little Rock Nine until I started doing my research for this. We have to keep learning and keep educating ourselves on the events that have happened in our country, so we can hopefully make better choices.
I hope so. And it's interesting, too, to look at it now from an adult's perspective, because I know we learned it in school. But, you know, when you're a kid, you're like a psychopath and you don't have any empathy. It's like, and also it just goes over your head. And now as someone who's an adult and you really realize, like, how young these kids were and what pressure, like, and he even said, like, the pressure of desegregation was on their shoulders. You know, they had to endure this, because if they dropped out, then the other side would win. And so I thought, you know, that really was poignant. But do you think that you want to change the verdict, or are you sticking with it?
I think that we should stick with what we had. Ultimately, we sent the governor to the alarmist jail, and we sent racism, which is segregation, right? We gave racism the big slap. I think we should have put segregation up on the board, but I do think we probably would have come up with the same outcome. And I think Rebecca, Amanda, Tony, and Clayton that day pointed the finger at Governor Faubus. We played Dr. Kirk's game, and we ended up pointing the finger at him. So we should stick with that.
Yeah, we spun the wheel of this blame. One. Yeah, I agree.
All right. Well, thanks again to Dr. Kirk for all of his insight. And tune in next week. We are going to be covering the Britney Spears conservatorship.
Earios.
Powered by Acast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.